A little bit, yeah. So I'm going to be talking about work done in collaboration with two graduate students at Florida State, Leila Hormozi and George Zikos, and also Steve Simon at Lucent. And I thought I'd start with what was sort of the inspiration, which goes back to, I distinctly remember seeing this, watching this talk given by Michael Friedman back in 2000. I didn't understand the title, I still don't understand the title, a topological modular functor, which is universal for quantum computation. And I didn't understand much of the talk, but I found this, I mean, I distinctly remember seeing this and thinking, that's cool. And also wondering, what does, you know, so, and I knew at that time in 2000 I was beginning to learn about quantum computing. I said, well, I wonder what a controlled NOT gate looks like for this kind of quantum computer. And that's essentially the problem that, that we solved and that I'm going to be talking about today. And in fact, so last night, this is one of those ideas that seemed good at the time. I actually made the controlled NOT gate. I made the gate, but you can see it looked much nicer last night. But of course, I just dumped it in my briefcase. But the good news is the fact that it sort of doesn't look that nice anymore. It doesn't matter. It's still a controlled NOT gate, which is sort of the point. I don't know if there's any reason to pass this around. You know. You know, so in fact, you could give that to some unfortunate student, and if that student has been sitting in on some of these tutorials, they would know maybe where to look up in books or who to ask, how to actually calculate the unitary operation that corresponds to that. And if I did everything right last night, it should be a controlled NOT gate to within about one part in a thousand or so. And the point is, of course, all of these theories of not abelian anions, they have nice, well-defined rules that allow you to go from the braid to the actual gate. And in fact, you know, you only have to multiply about 100 matrices to, you wouldn't need a quantum computer, of course, to show that that's a controlled NOT gate. So that's, it's easy to go from at least braids with just a few strands to the actual matrix. But in order to find that, we had to solve the inverse problem. So that's what I'm going to be talking about, how we actually did that. So just to set the stage, everyone here is, I'm sure, familiar with the quantum circuit model of quantum computation, and here the idea is we can decompose any quantum algorithm into a sequence of single qubit rotations and some entangling two qubit gate, for example, a controlled NOT gate. And this is useful not just for thinking about quantum algorithms, but also for thinking about how to build a quantum computer. One of the many things you have to do if you're proposing a quantum computer is tell people how you're going to carry out your single qubit rotations and how you're going to do your controlled NOT gates. And so, for example, and there are, of course, lots of ways to do this. One way, here's the spintronics part of the talk. One way to go would be, you know, using, for example, electron spins as your qubit. And this is something people are talking about just across the courtyard. And then carrying out your quantum gates by manipulating the electron spins with electric and magnetic fields. And of course, and people are making tremendous progress in this. But there's the problem of error and decoherence, which may, in principle, I mean, can be solved by using quantum error correction, but it's certainly going to be difficult. And of course, this is just one of many schemes where your qubit is some local two-level system, which is coupled to the environment, hopefully weakly, but still somewhat, and there's going to be some source of decoherence, and that's going to be a problem. Another way to go is what was proposed, I think, first by Alexei Kateyev and also outlined in this paper here, the idea of topological quantum computing. Now, I know many people here know all about this topic, but maybe not everyone. So let me just sort of review the basic idea. And the surprising direction this takes us in is to something called the quantum Hall effect. The fractional quantum Hall effect. And this is something that occurs if we have a two-dimensional gas of electrons in a strong magnetic field. At certain values of the filling fraction, when it has a rational value, it's possible for these electrons to condense into some incompressible fluid. So that blue thing is this incompressible fluid. And we've known for a long time that this stuff has magical properties. For example, it has a fractionally charged excitation. So if I take an electron and put it into a nu equals one third state, the electron fractionalizes, for the case nu equals one third, into three fractionally charged quasiparticles with a charge E over 3. So this is great stuff. What does this have to do with quantum computing? Well, one link can be seen when you consider this sort of theoretical curiosity first emphasized by Wen, that if you take fractional quantum Hall states, just even the ordinary nu equals one third fractional quantum Hall state, and put it on topologically non-trivial surfaces, you get some degeneracies. So if you put it on a sphere, you have a unique ground state. If you put it on a torus with a single hole, there's a threefold degeneracy, and so on and so on. It grows exponentially with the number of holes in your surface. And these states are topologically degenerate. That means no local measurement can tell you which of these, say, three states you're in here. It requires a global measurement to determine what state you're in. So this is sort of a perfect place to put quantum information if you could. But of course, it's hard to imagine how you could actually do that, or how you would, if you could, how you would manipulate it, at least for these ordinary quantum Hall states. However, Warren Reed, back 15 years ago, proposed that at the time, at least in principle, they said, there could exist particularly exotic quantum Hall states where the electron fractionalizes in a particularly exotic way, so that if you have some number of these fractionally charged excitations, you don't just have a unique state. If I just freeze them here, there's actually a degenerate Hilbert space whose dimensionality grows exponentially with the number of these quasiparticles. And again, if these quasiparticles are sufficiently far apart, these states are topologically degenerate. So no local measurement can distinguish the different states. So again, this is a perfect place to put quantum information. And now we have a handle to manipulate the information. We can actually imagine, manipulating these quasiparticles and moving them around each other in some pattern. And to understand how that actually would manipulate this quantum information or this Hilbert space, I just want to again review some of the properties of statistics in 2+1 dimensions very quickly. So we all know if we have, say, some number of particles here in two space dimensions, three particles here, if I interchange, say, these two particles in a clockwise sense, then if I draw the time dimension is the third dimension here. These particles, as they do this interchange, will sweep out some world lines. And these world lines live in three space dimensions. And so they form what's called a braid. And what's interesting is if I start with the same three particles in the same state, but I interchange them not in a clockwise sense, but in a counterclockwise sense, then again, they sweep out a braid. But this braid is of course, obviously not topologically equivalent to this braid. In two dimensions, in two space dimensions, and only in two space dimensions, clockwise exchange of particles is not equivalent to counterclockwise exchange of particles. And what that means is the final state of the system, after I do this interchange, doesn't just depend on the permutation of the particles. It can depend on the way in which the exchange took place in 2+1 dimensions. So it actually can depend on the braid. And of course, one of the consequences of this is the possibility for ordinary abelian fractional statistics. So here I have a bunch of quasiparticles, and let's say I have a unique state, and I move the two particles around each other. Because clockwise exchanges are not equivalent to counterclockwise exchanges, the effect of this operation doesn't have to be equal to its own inverse, or it doesn't have to square to 1. So it can be some complex phase. Again, if there's a unique state here, that's all that can happen. In three dimensions, that phase has to be either 1 or -1, of course, corresponding to bosons or fermions. because it has to square to one, because there's no distinction between clockwise and counterclockwise exchanges. But in 2+1 dimensions, it's possible to have that's not necessary, and it's possible to have a phase here. That's in fact what people believe with almost complete certainty happens in the fractional quantum Hall effect, that you have some phase of e to the I pi over 3 for those fractionalized quasi-particles I showed you earlier.
Could you move your bag, please?
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay, so that's ordinary abelian statistics. What Moore and Reed showed is, at least for the states they constructed, that here you have some, if you have some degenerate space, so here we have these quasi-particles where of the non-abelian type, so now we have some degenerate state. Let's say it's twofold degenerate in this case. Then when we do this interchange, we end up with another state, a different superposition. So here the coefficients alpha, beta now become alpha and beta Quiddle. And if I represent these as column vectors, then there's some matrix now associated with this interchange. And again, in 2+1 dimensions, this matrix, you know, because this matrix doesn't have to be equal to its own inverse, because clockwise and counterclockwise exchanges aren't equivalent. It doesn't have to square to one. In other words, this matrix doesn't just depend on the permutation of the particles after we do the exchange. It depends on the actual topology of the path. So these form what is called a non-abelian representation of the Braid group, which is related to all sorts of fancy stuff, which there are a number of people who are real experts on this stuff. But actually, to understand most of this, to understand this talk, you're not going to have to know much about these things. But topological quantum field theories and conformal field theory, in fact, it's conformal field theory, this construction through conformal field theory that Moore and Reed used to construct the first of these states, the Moore-Reed state, and then subsequent states by Reed and Rezai. So this is the, if you have some state with these properties, then the idea is, if I have lots of these non-abelian anions, then the system is in some initial state. I move them around each other in some pattern. It ends up in some final state. And again, it's going to depend on some matrix. And here again, the point is, the matrix doesn't just depend on the permutation of the particles. It depends on the actual braid. And furthermore, again, provided the particles are kept sufficiently far apart throughout this whole process, and provided everything is done adiabatically, if the path is deformed a little bit, or even a lot, as long as it's topologically equivalent to the original path, the matrix is unchanged. And so this is the basic idea of Kateyev and Friedman, that the sort of built-in physical fault tolerance in these systems makes this sort of the natural, it may make this the natural stuff you want to make quantum computers out of.
Can you explain why?
Well,
it's stable under small perturbation and unstable under cutting third jet.
Well, that's sort of what I've been trying to. I mean, that's a. well, let's see. I mean, the. I'm not sure. I mean, if you have particles with these properties, which has not been shown, then this, in fact, is. I mean, you would, if they have these non-abelian statistics, you would expect. I mean, or one of the properties is the actual operation you perform on the Hilbert space only depends on the topology of the braid. Again, I just said it. I mean, there's a long chain of reasoning, starting with the wave functions are constructed from conformal field theory, and the conformal blocks in the conformal field theory braid in a certain way. I would say, at least in my opinion, no one has. I mean, what I would like to see is some explicit calculation, or maybe even an experiment, where you actually show this. But even an explicit calculation, I would say, hasn't been done. Yeah. Yes. You'd want a Hamiltonian. Yeah. The dream numeric. I mean, there have been some stabs at numerical calculations, like by Steve Simon and one of his students. I forget his name. Where they did Monte Carlo calculations. Oh, is he here? I'm sorry. and in fact, in my opinion, that's sort of the only real numerical evidence that the braiding properties of these things have his property. Yes.
Let me just take a stab at answering that question. The ground state for the protective panel permits that we discussed are closed spaces in the sense that it's impossible to find local operators in Hilbert space which act on the ground space. So in other words, if you take the lowest energy eigenspace of the Hamiltonian, which describes the system, and you consider the projection, which projects from the Hilbert space approximately out to that subspace, mm-hmm. it's not possible to find a local operator which, if you include the subspace, do the operator, and followed by a orthogonal projection, is any different than scaling. So it's not possible to act locally on the space. And that explains the microscopic stability. And this code property, it's sort of a cryptographic property of the subspace, can be verified in combinatorial models, certainly.
I think because you add background potential, all these degeneracies would go away.
Well, no, not if the particles are sufficiently far apart.
And the crucial thing is, like, well, from a business point of view, there's a gap, and there's a and there's a characteristic length scale, which...
Right, the magnetic length. Or the
magnetic length. And you want to keep particles much further apart than that.
If on a torus, I would put the background potential, the ground state would not be degenerate.
No, it is degenerate. In the thermodynamic limit, it becomes degenerate exponentially fast. And that's even if you don't believe it, it's even been shown numerically. Right.
Okay. That context is enough.
Yeah.
But I think that you can, you know, this one case where you can show it on a modern Hamiltonian, that
the P wave superconductor,
which would not be lifted by putting it there of potential. Okay, and this is the part of the, as you put it, as the P wave superconductor. There you can show that putting a scalar potential will not...
Look, I understand the Hofstadter model. In the Hofstadter model, there is no degeneracy.
But if you had that's not the fraction, that's a non-interacting model. If you had
the Landau Hamiltonian on a torus with a
back. But no interactions.
No interactions.
Right. These are strongly correlated states.
If the statement is true with interactions, it should be true.
That's not true.
No, it wouldn't be true without interactions. In the same way that the one cell would not be a quantum world state.
If you put on a random scalar potential which is stronger than the gap,
you'd cause problems, right? Well, you'd create particle hole pairs and
you're gonna get low energy excitations.
Right. But I'm actually sort of with you in that I still would like to be convinced more.
Yeah.
But I you know, at the moment I just want to believe.
This criteria problem, the only way to do this compellingly is actually doing calculations.
For me, yeah.
This I think needs to be done.
Right.
But in a way, sorry, it's two separate questions. One is the low energy state of the system really in some topological phase, which I agree up with calculations. But if you know it is, and all the rest of what the papers then follow.
Right.
Okay.
But yes. You could still ask questions like, how far is far enough? And,
yeah.
And that's all. I mean, there are still questions of details, which become quite important for actual implementation, but not for the theoretical issue. And I think this calculation thing to be done. I mean, you know, Steve did one, and Linus and Martin actually did one for...
I mean, and Haldane is sort of creeping up on similar...
And what he claims to be finding, to let somebody understand him, is a bit disturbing, but that's a separate issue.
Okay. So, all right, this...
So what are the degrees of freedom that destroy that? Or what is the idea then? What do you excite? What is the other thing except the topological interaction, which is pretty clear, explained, and understood? What is it that destroys that topological feature? The global... I know there are certain global observables in this theory. You can easily define it. So you want to make some calculation involving this global observables and then have an other physical effect that destroys or changes that, whatever it is, the correlation function or whatever. What are they?
So if somewhere along this colorful,
Right. So a pair forms here, and then it goes around.
Okay. That's again the question of the gaps themselves.
Yeah.
No. Okay. So it's always something that has to do with the distance of the
gap. Is not infinite.
No. I know it's infinite. So there is a finite probability, but that is, an estimate of that must be not too hard to make, I guess.
Well, in fact, you
would. Depends on what you mean by hard. Yes, it's a direct numerical calculation, they're not easy to do. It's not a theoretical argument first. You need to handle something and do it. And I think this will get done. And we'll hopefully get what Nick is claiming to be true. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, the game ends, you worry the game. So that's not a good thing.
Yes, please.
In a superconducting system, you also have humans, you also have a gap.
Yes.
And we know that the gap itself is not guaranteed.
Right. I mean, here you have this topological order.
What is the difference here now? Because, in a superconducting system, I have a gap, and I could use a similar argument and say, there's an excitation which brings me about that gap, and therefore it shouldn't have any equilibrium. It's not true, because we know there is a magnetic flux which goes out of the system, and that will get the superposition of those states.
Right. Well, again, the hope here is that the different states are cannot be. I mean, in the superconductor, you can still locally determine which state the qubit is in. Although they work very hard to make it, to make it difficult to see. But here, the dream is that as you pull the particles apart, this degeneracy becomes exact exponentially fast, and any local measurement cannot tell what state you're in. You'd have to perform some measurement. Say, if you want to know the state of these two quasi particles, you have to measure all the way around them somehow.
And you may have degenerate.
Local measurement. They introduce the phase parameter and some Lagrangian that involves the phase parameter. In this model, they introduce virtual particles that come in. For instance, if you do computation with non-linear, the worst process is coming over virtual particles from one minimum to the other. And there are other tunneling processes, like tunneling here and tuning here. And you can introduce them as some phenomenological parameters.
Yeah.
But in the end, since there is a gap, this tunneling amplitudes decay exponential. We can do it then also.
Okay. I guess actually this is a pretty controversial slide, so it's not surprising. Pretty soon. I didn't realize when I was making it. So again, the question is, do these states exist, or can we make them? And there at least there's certainly one case where I think there's a very compelling case that one of these not abelian states exists. That's the nu equals five half state, based on numerics by people like Morf and Haldane and Zai. There's a very strong, convincing evidence. There's very strong evidence that the five half state is this Mohr-Reed-Bothian state. There, the quasi particles have charge E over 4, and their braiding properties, up to unimportant details, are described by this so-called SU2 level 2 Chern-Simons theory, which is. And so, while I think the case is very strong that these exist, and in fact people have proposed and are trying experiments to verify these funny statistics, this is not sufficiently rich for doing universal quantum computation, although people have proposed various schemes which are sort of mixed schemes, at least to the extent I understand them, where you do some things topologically and some things not topologically. So it may still be useful for quantum computation, but not, you can't do everything topologically. And the same data taken in 2004, or actually before then, but published in 2004, you can see this the 12-fifth state. And this state is possibly, I mean, the case is not nearly as strong, and but a case can be made. And the numerics, certainly, when I talk to Ed Rezai, seems to indicate that there is some stable range of parameters where this state is, in fact, stable. Whether that's actually what happens in the second Landau level at 2/5, or in the first Landau level at 2/5, is not clear yet. But
what do you mean by stable?
What I just tell you what Ed says. Ed says there's a gap, and there's, although I know that other people who've not published anything. Yeah, but we shouldn't. Yeah, let's wait till these guys publish their papers.
I think Ed found a gap in a model where he slightly changed one of the Hubbings to potential C1.
Right. So there's some Hamiltonian with a two-body interaction, which in some region in phase space. So there's at least some simple Hamiltonian with this exotic state. At least there's, whether that's actually what happens is what's more controversial. But if it does, then the state, the quasi-particles charge is E over 5 in this case, and their braiding properties, again, up to sort of abelian phases, which aren't going to matter for us because we're talking about quantum computing, so we don't care about the overall phase any braid produces, are described by this SU2 level 3 Chern-Simons theory, and that has been shown to be sufficiently rich to do universal quantum computation. And unfortunately, this is the last physics slide, last slide with data on it in the talk. And not only that, I want to see if I can pull a fast one. And I want to even, the SU is, again, if you, all you care about is what I'm talking about, which is actually finding braids which do certain quantum computations, the braiding properties of SU2 level 3 are actually, again, up to overall phases, equivalent to something called to SO3 level 3. And which is the so-called Fibonacci anion model, which is much simpler than this. And so I'd just like to immediately go to the Fibonacci anion model, unless people stop me and ask. I mean, I can try and convince you that that's true, but several people have shown it using different techniques. It's not, I think, a particularly controversial statement. So we can even use the simplest model of not abelian anions, these so-called Fibonacci anions. So here's a Fibonacci anion, which is going to describe one of these quasi-particles in the 12-5th state. I put your name there only because I learned everything I know about them from your notes. But yeah, I should put Cooper Briggs' name. Well, there's Fibonacci at least. I don't know, he shouldn't get any credit for that. So here's a Fibonacci anion, and one can use this essentially this quantum group language we learned about in one of the tutorials, and think of the degree of freedom that this thing has as like a Q-deformed spin, or I'll call it Q-spin, and in fact the Fibonacci anions have Q-spin 1. And if we have a collection of these Fibonacci anions, they can have a total Q-spin of either 0 or 1. And so I'm going to introduce a notation, which I'm going to use here. I'm going to draw a circle around. If I draw a circle around a bunch of Fibonacci anions and label it, that label just says that these anions are in an eigenstate of Q-spin, and they either have Q-spin 0 or Q-spin 1. Just like ordinary spin, there are rules for combining Q-spin. There's really only one non-trivial fusion rule, which says that if we combine two Q-spin 1 objects, we end up with something with either Q-spin 0 or Q-spin 1. These are ordinary spins. We'd also have spin 2, but that's gone for the Fibonacci anions. There are only two possible values for the spin. The other fusion rules tell you that if you combine 0 with 1, you get 1, and 0 with 0, you get 0. But those are, I think, quite plausible. So what this means is that if we take two of these Fibonacci anions, they can have total Q-spin 0 or 1, or they can be in any quantum superposition of those two states. So we end up with a two-dimensional Hilbert space. Here are the two Fibonacci anions in with a state with total Q-spin 0. Here they have total Q-spin 1. And they can be, as I say, in any superposition. If I add a third Fibonacci anion, then you can see if these two guys, have Q spin zero, if I add a third one, this guy, the total Q spin of all three has to be one. If the Q spin of these two is one, and I add one, it could be either one or zero. So in fact, we can construct three basis states in this way. So it's a three-dimensional Hilbert space for three Fibonacci anions, and it's a useful exercise, to generalize this. So here I've drawn six Fibonacci anions, and I'm going to imagine combining the Q spin of these two first, then adding this one and this one and this one and this one and so forth. And here's a fusion diagram or a Bertelli diagram for the case of Fibonacci anion. So here the number of particles is on the x-axis and the total Q spin is on the y-axis. So if I introduce a single Fibonacci anion, it has Q spin 1. If I add the second one, we saw the fusion rule tells us that it can either have Q spin 1 or Q spin 0. So there are these two lines here. If the two combined have Q spin 0, if I add a third one, it has to have Q spin 1. Whereas if the two had Q spin 1, it could have either 0 or 1, and so forth and so on. So this diagram is sort of a useful way to think about the Hilbert space, or the basis states, or a particular basis choice for this Hilbert space. So for example, you know, here's one way of labeling these ovals, which is consistent with the fusion rules. And here's the path in the Bertelli diagram, which corresponds to that. So these two have 0, and then if I add a third, it comes up to 1, then 1, and down to 0 again, 1. And here's another one. So we go to 1, and then 0, 1, 1, 0. And so one way to we can actually determine the degeneracy of the Hilbert space just by counting the paths in this diagram. And if we do that, we get this result, which is familiar to people here. So certainly there's only one way to go from here to here, and there's one way to go here. Likewise, again, I have to go here. I have to go up here. One way to go here. But now when I come to this point here, the path can connect from here or here. So there are two possible paths. 1 + 1 = 2. And likewise, if down here it's going to be, again, there's only one path from here to here. But 1 + 2 = 3. So I keep basically, I just add these previous two for the top line. And one gets this familiar result that the degeneracy grows as the Fibonacci sequence. So that's of course an exponentially large Hilbert space in the number of quasi particles, so it's big enough to do quantum computing. Let's see, I think I may skip. There are a few extra bits of mathematics one needs to be able to calculate everything you need with these particles. One is, for example, I showed you a particular basis choice where we combined these two and then added the third. But I could have just as easily combined the second two and then added this one here. And these define bases that span the same Hilbert space, so there has to exist some unitary transformation that takes you from one to the other. And in fact, that matrix is up to, again, irrelevant phases, determined uniquely by this consistency condition, again, we've learned about in the tutorials, the pentagon equation, which I won't show you here, but it actually is, for these fusion rules, it's essentially uniquely determined. And what's also uniquely determined is the effect of exchanging particles. If I exchange two particles and their total Q spin is zero, I get one phase factor I've shown here. If I exchange these two, I get a different phase factor. You can think of these as sort of Q-deformed versions of the plus one or minus one you get when you exchange two spin one half particles if they're in a triplet or a singlet. But here we get something that's not plus or minus one. It's a phase, which means we have to define what sense we exchange the particles. And again, these phases are fixed by these consistency conditions. In this case, it's the hexagon equation, which we've also seen in the tutorial. And once you have these, you can calculate the effect of braiding, the result of any braid on this funny Fibonacci Hilbert space. Okay, so now how are we going to do quantum computing? And so we have this very strange Hilbert space. It doesn't have the usual tensor product structure of a collection of qubits one is used to for quantum computing. And so at least one thing to do, and maybe this is not the right way to go, but it's so far, as far as I know, it's the only way people have thought of, including me, is just to enforce that qubit structure onto this Hilbert space. So encode qubits. And we could encode qubits with two quasi-particles, but as I showed in the previous slide, you know, if we just use two qubits, if we interchange them, we can only get some overall phase factor. We can't induce transitions from 0 to 1, so that we can't do arbitrary single qubit rotation. So that's not very convenient. And the minimum number of the minimum number of quasi-particles you can use to encode a qubit is 3. And this was actually originally proposed in this paper. And so here are the qubit states. So for 3 Fibonacci anions, it's a 3-dimensional Hilbert space. There are two states with overall Q spin 1. Those are going to be the qubit states. And the value, the qubit will be in the state 0 if these two guys have total Q spin 0. It'll be in the state 1 if these two guys have total Q spin 1. And the price we pay is the same price one pays in all these encoding schemes, which are not unique to topological quantum computing. There's some non-computational state. And one of the things we're going to have to work hard to do is make sure that when we start braiding these things together, we don't induce transitions from the qubit state to the non-computational state. Those transitions I'll refer to as leakage errors. Right. Yeah. Although you'll see, inevitably they occur. We can only make them as small as, once we start pulling particles out of their. Let's see. You'll see. I mean, but you're right. If the brain, you know, it's not going to be this. You'll see that this is not easy to do necessarily. Yeah. Yes.
In the level of feature, since the quantum dimension is square root of 2.
Yes.
It suggests that maybe you could encode qubits without any inefficiency.
But then I'm not sure. But you know, here.
I mean, you don't have universal gradient to make
qubits. Right. Well, I mean, the same thing is true here. I mean, one could encode qubits. There's nothing to stop me from encoding qubits into just pairs of particles, which would be. I just would lose this ability to perform arbitrary single qubit rotations.
Well,
that's true. That's true. We're still throwing away some of the Hilbert space. Yeah. That's true. You know, and again, this is not unique to the topological quantum computing business. There are people who talk about doing quantum computing using the exchange interaction only with spins. So you work in, say, the singlet subspace, and there you can draw a Bertelli diagram. They're throwing away much more Hilbert space, and. But you're right. For the level 2 theory, you can have an efficient. You're not throwing. You can have an encoding scheme where you're not throwing away any Hilbert. It's not true here. At least as far as I know, I don't know any.
I have a question.
Yeah.
Is this local or non-local? I mean, the error can happen with a local error or.
No. What? Let's. Well, it depends what you mean. I mean, if say, a particle-hole pair appears here and goes around like this and then annihilates, then, let's see, I think that would in general induce some transition, some leakage error. So, again, in the dream, these particles are kept, they're 10 or 20 magnetic lengths apart, and the temperature is, you know, you're well below the gap, so you're not thermally exciting these pairs. And in that case, I mean, it would require a global error.
Why are you then talking about the leakage error at all?
Because I'm talking about errors not in the due to decoherence or coupling to the environment. I'm actually talking about errors due to just when we start braiding these things together. We only, you know, when the braids, we're only handed a finite number of elementary braid generators. This is, again, this problem is exactly, you know, equivalent to this problem that David DiVincenzo and Guido and others solved for the singlet. You know, in fact, they used a three-spin qubit, which is the Q-deform version of their qubit. And they also had to work hard, as I recall, to find a sequence of pulses that didn't induce. And this was precisely the error they were trying. One of the errors they're trying to avoid. So, yeah. Here I'm assuming I've forgotten about decoherence. It's just I just wanted to find some braid that eliminate doesn't have reach a transitions to that state.
And this encoding with this model, that's just an asymptotic result, though, right? I mean, for any finite level of encoding, you'd still have some leakage to contend with, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
So worth thinking about, at least at some level, for any finite implication.
Yeah. No. If you could somehow use the state, or I guess the idea of not having these leakage errors would be. I've thought about it, and I don't have any good ideas really.
Sometimes it seems like these topological states don't naturally get.
Yeah, that's the problem. We're taking these.
I mean, it's a shame there isn't some other.
Well, there may well be. The overall lesson of all of this may be that that one should look for that other algorithm. But did you have a question?
Oh no, just a remark. So maybe it's good to say that these leakage errors, really they aren't errors in the traditional sense of the word. I mean, you know exactly what's happening to the system.
Right. These are errors under unitary evolution, and just leakage, perhaps. Yeah, you're right, it's not an error. You're right, error is a very bad word.
The approximation of the gate on this subspace that you're trying to get.
Right.
I mean, there's not an error in what you're...
I'm still going to call it error, though. I think it's just, but I take your point.
But it's not fundamentally different than the inaccuracy in the approximation to an ideal gate even before in the computational space.
Yes, right. So for practical purposes, it's like an error. And that's why I guess I'm not going to, I don't think I'm going to change. So now one can actually use, if you just take those F and R matrices, it's easy to work out. In fact, I think this was, again, outlined in one of the tutorials how you would do this. You can calculate the braid matrices that act on this three-dimensional Hilbert space of three Fibonacci anions. So there are two elements, where there are four elementary braids, sigma 1 and sigma 2 here, and their inverses, where sigma 1, I'm interchanging the bottom two with a certain sense. And it's easy to work out that matrix because I'm interchanging particles. If I work in this basis labeled by these quantum numbers C and A, I'm always interchanging particles in a well-defined state of Q-spin, so I just get a diagonal matrix, and these are just those phases in the R matrix. Whereas here, it's a little bit more difficult because I'm interchanging these two particles, but the way to calculate this matrix is just apply the F matrix to change basis where these two particles are in a Q-spin eigenstate. In that basis, braiding them produces this, and then undo that change, and if you work everything out, you get this not very illuminating matrix. But one of the points here is, and then how you can use these then to calculate for an arbitrary braid, you can just divide any arbitrary braid, three braid, into these elementary braid operations. And associated with each of them is some sigma 1. Multiply them all together, and you get some matrix M. And that matrix M just describes the evolution of the system. And one of the nice things here is, you can see, is a general property of these non-abelian anions or quantum groups, and that any amount of braiding we do within an oval, you can see these matrices are blocked diagonal, doesn't induce any transition in the total Q-spin of that oval. So there's no coupling from the C equals, C is the total Q-spin of these three particles. From the C equals 1 sector, that's the qubit, to the C equals 0 sector. That's exactly 0. So,
So, are you using the
strand
theory,
unit
theory,
like
using the Gaussian ratio?
Why am I using tau? You mean, this is 1 over tau.
Yeah, that's the...
But I think these matrices are still right. I mean, saying I should use another symbol. I guess I use phi for the golden mean and tau for 1 over the golden mean, and I'm not sure whether I got that from your notes.
Sorry.
So,
it's notation.
But I think this is, once the notation is made consistent, this should be. And so there's this general rule that when we braid inside an oval, it doesn't change the total Q-spin. And there's an immediate consequence that as long as we braid within a qubit, there's no leakage error. And then it's just a question of whether we can do arbitrary single qubit rotations, something one can't do for the level 2 theory. But for the level 3 theory, these rotations generate a dense cover of SU2, and we can even see that. So here's, I mean, again, single qubit operations are just rotations. This form here, so I can represent them with a rotation vector living inside the sphere of radius 2 pi. And if I just take those matrices and ask what the rotations they perform on the qubit space is for, and here, for reasons that will become clear, hopefully, I'm actually considering the square generators because that essentially takes the middle particle and weaves it out and then back. It brings the middle particle back to the same position at the end. So these are four sigma 1 squared, sigma 1 inverse squared, sigma 2 inverse squared, sigma 2 squared. These are four sort of weaving processes where the middle particle is brought around either the bottom or top qubit. And these are the rotations they produce. There's, I think, 6 pi over 5 or something like that, rotations about either the z-axis for sigma 1 or some angle like the arctangent of the golden mean or something like that. So let me just remove the vector. So those are those points, and this is, let's say, a typical braid. If I now consider braids with two of these square generators, then of course I have 16 points, and we can keep doing that. So here's 32, so on, and you can see something which is sort of, I think, obvious, because the number of braids, I'm just showing a single braid here, but the number of braids grows exponentially fast. And you can see that in this picture. I think it goes all the way to 11. One rapidly fills the sphere. So, and that just reflects the fact that, you know, for a linear increase in the braid, the number of extra points I add here is growing exponentially. So one can very rapidly get a good approximation to whatever single qubit rotation you want. And so we can actually carry this out further. I think this has about 26 of those generators or something like that. And this is the result of a brute force search looking for, a kind of boring gate, just a knot gate. And if we go out to about this length, first of all, it takes about a week. But we can get to an accuracy of one part in 1,000 or so, which is great. And again, because, you know, the number of braids grows exponentially, as this gets longer and longer, the accuracy improves rapidly. The trouble is, of course, we can't do, this is sort of the limit of our brute force searches, and probably around here is the lifetime of the universe or something like that. But fortunately, there is a very clever algorithm. So, right, brute force searching rapidly becomes infeasible as the braids get longer, but there's a clever algorithm due to Solovay and Kitaev that allows for systematic improvement of this braid given a sufficiently dense covering of SU2. So once we have this library of braids up to a certain length, provided it's sufficiently dense, we can just take those braids and sew them together in a certain way to get better and better approximations to the gate we want. It's not as efficient as the optimal braid if we could do brute force searching, but it does give you essentially an exponentially improving braid. So here's the result of an actual one iteration of the sort of the most simple-minded version of this algorithm applied to this braid, and you can see the accuracy has grown by a factor of 10. For this particular implementation, the braid grows by a factor of 5, and if you work it out, you can see the braid length. If we keep doing iterations, it's done recursively, so every time we do the braid, it grows by another factor of 5. But the error improves in such a way that the braid length scales roughly as log epsilon to the fourth power, something like that. And again, actually, there's nothing particularly unique to topological quantum computing about this. This is something any fault-tolerant quantum computer, I think, is going to have to be doing, because you'll only have a finite number of fault-tolerant gates. But I show you this just to say that the problem of three braids, braiding three particles, is something we have under control. In fact, if you give me a matrix, I can find a braid that approximates it to whatever accuracy, and with at most this polylogarithmic scaling with the error. So that part is easy. Yeah.
So presumably there's a minimum number of braids you can use to generate a base instead of gates, which then you can use the Solovay type.
Yeah.
Arbitrary.
Yes.
Do you have any idea?
I think people do know. I mean, there is some. Once you have an epsilon net of a certain refinement, and I think that number people have. I don't know if there are estimates of that number or bounds on that number, but people. I think not me, but people know. You know how accurate. Once the net has reached a certain point, then then you can carry out this algorithm.
But it's like algorithmic information. It's some integer, right? For this,
yes.
We're given a model at some
yes.
number.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. Yes. So I don't know how fine the epsilon net is. Although it doesn't have to be that. It doesn't have to be that good. I mean, certainly here we're using a very fine epsilon net, which essentially is, you know, if you want to have the braid be the shortest length possible, you want to first do the brute force search as far out as you can go, and then carry out this this algorithm. But we can even do it if we have, you know, even with the braids are shorter, we can, you know, Kateyev-Solovay still works and converges. And, you know, I can look up, I know where, I, you know, I think people know about what that exact threshold is. And
we have a certain round on it, right?
Yeah, well, tell you, yeah, but this is an extreme case, because we're really going for efficiency here.
Because we get out of the convex space.
Remember here, there's no lead, because we're braiding within an oval, this rule, it doesn't lead to transitions out of the state. So this is an error just because I'm trying to produce this gate, but I only have a finite number of fault-tolerant gates I can carry out. And again, this looks sort of intimidating, but it you know, this is the same sort of thing people are going to have to do with any quantum computer, I think. It's being run fault-tolerantly, so.
I mean, in other words, saying that instead of producing this gate, you're exactly producing some other gate.
That's right, yeah. Yeah, that's probably a better way to say it. But so there was some, yeah, you're right. So in my mind, there's some target gate, which is the simple not gate, and that doesn't occur naturally in this covering. We can only get approximately there, yeah. But there is some exact gate, of course, with no, I mean, there is some exact unitary gate that this realizes. Yes? Well, that, yeah, I mean, well, we certainly have, yeah. We can make anyone to, but he's asking with a finite sequence, do we maybe luck onto a Hadamard gate or some useful gate? For SU2 level 3, where we've certainly had our eyes out, no. But maybe for higher Ks, there's a vast unexplored territory of, but it doesn't seem like that's true for level 3. Okay, so that was all the easy part. The hard part is 2-qubit gates. I don't know how much time I have, but I can probably get through the 2-qubit gate story, I think. So here the problem is now we have two of these qubits, and if we're going to start entangling them, literally, we're going to have to start pulling particles out of their qubits, out of their ovals, and that's this. That so we no longer have this protection against leakage errors or against leakage. So in general, for a braid like this, we don't know the qubits are in general going to make transitions out of the state with Q-spin 1. So leakage error is a problem. That's one. Another problem is if you just look at the dimensionality of the Hilbert space, better to say, the number of free parameters in the space of gates acting on that Hilbert space, which is SU5 plus SU8. It's 87 dimensional. In other words, the analog of the three-dimensional sphere I showed you earlier, which we were filling up exponentially, is now 87 dimensional, and that means even though it's still being filled up exponentially, it's much less efficient. And in fact, one can't, you know, just by doing brute force searches over these things, one cannot find particularly good gates or a particularly dense covering. So, as a matter of principle, one could actually apply Solovay-Kateyev in this bigger group and find, you know, arbitrary 2-qubit gates. It's really, I don't think, practical. And as I say, even if you could do it, I don't think, you know, once, you know, you could do a brute force search out to a certain length, and then one iteration of this Solovay-Kateyev, and it would grow by a factor of 5 or something like that. And you would end up with, I think, very long braids to carry out your 2-qubit gates.
Why can't you reach all of SU13?
Because there's a detail I haven't been talking about, which is, you know, these qubits, this particular encoding, the qubits have Q-spin 1, which means the total Q-spin of the two qubits can be either 0 or 1. So there are two sectors. And the Q-spin 0 sector is 5-dimensional, and the Q-spin 1 sector is 8-dimensional. And so the matrices corresponding to the elementary braid operations here are block diagonal in SU5 and SU8. So and that's in fact another kind of error, or I don't know what the right term is, that we want to avoid. We want to make sure whatever we do, it shouldn't care about the total Q-spin. It should, you know, we don't want to entangle the computational space of the qubits with this fusion space of these guys. But I claim the constructions just will by inspection satisfy that property. Yeah.
So maybe it's nice to say here that if you want to reduce this kind of leakage error,
yes.
And if you have these orbital processes, of course you can put 3 qubits in 6 particles. And that way you get a slightly better
yeah.
The number of states you want to look at and the number of states you don't want to look at.
Yeah.
But I think that it's not obvious that it's going to work with it. It's you have to show the gap and not the
Well, I mean,
I don't see any advantage.
Yeah, I mean, I'm open to all sorts of suggestions. And by the way, I mean, this is all 100 years too early. We have to wait till these materials. Yeah. But I think it's worth sort of pursuing this to its ultimate end to understand what this looks like as sort of a starting point to think about maybe better schemes. I understand what you're saying, and I'm not sure. I don't know if it would lead to any advantage, but I also don't know. Right. So how do we solve this problem? I think I can actually tell that story pretty quickly with almost no equations. So I want to do a 2-qubit gate, and in particular, I'm going to consider controlled gates. So I'm going to have a control qubit, which is in blue, and a target qubit, which is in green. And the state, remember, these two guys, it's the total Q-spin of these two guys, which determines the state of the qubit. So this is in state B, and this is in state A. And a controlled qubit, gate, is one where we do something to the target. Some rotations performed on the target only if the control qubit is in the state 1. So only if this B label is 1. If B is 0, we want to do nothing. And we also want to avoid leakage. I claim that looking for this kind of gate sort of naturally suggests a construction. And that construction is to weave this pair of particles. So time is going left to right. But weave this pair of particles through the target in some way. The reason why this suggests itself is because if, in this case, if B is equal to 0, I guess another rule, which I didn't tell you but I think is quite plausible, is that the braiding of anything with Q-spin 0 is trivial. It just produces the identity. So if B is equal to 0, we do nothing. So we automatically get a controlled something. Because only if B is equal to 1 do we induce some transition in the target. So the case B equals 0 is trivial. We can forget about it. That takes care of itself. We get, you know, so only B equals 1 is non-trivial. And in that case, when B is equal to 1, this pair of particles is equivalent to a single Fibonacci anion, so I can actually replace it with a single particle. So this pair, which I'm calling the control pair, this is the case when the control pair is in the state with Q-spin 1, and I weave it through. And so we've actually, you know, just by drawing pictures, we've reduced the problem to weaving one anion around 3 others. So we're braiding 4 particles, which is not that much worse than braiding 3. But actually, that's still quite difficult to do a brute force search, much more difficult than the 3 braid case. So we can simplify our lives a little bit more and just consider weaving through 2 particles in the target. And so this is a problem I convince you we can solve. You know, if we find out there's some matrix we can apply here, I can get it for you easily and efficiently. And so one can ask then, we want to do something to the target, but we don't want to induce leakage. So we don't want to induce transitions from this state with this Q-spin that goes from 1 to 0. So we need to find a weaving pattern which does not induce leakage. And one can set up the equations for that and see and find the solution. But the answer, you know, can be expressed essentially with a picture. And that is the only weaving patterns that have this property are what we call effective braiding patterns. So here's a particular braiding of the two. These are two green particles. These are in the target. It turns out they have, for this construction, they have to be braided some even number of times. So in this case, twice. And that corresponds to this sigma 1 squared. So that's our target gate. That's the gate we want. Then we do a brute force search, but we restrict ourselves to considering these sorts of weaving patterns where I only touch this blue particle and weave it through. And so here's a sequence you can, at the, you know, at home you can multiply these matrices and see that sure enough, this product approximates this effective grading to one part in 1,000 again. So it's like this blue particle, by weaving it through, as far as the Hilbert space is concerned, it's equivalent to just braiding these two particles. So at least in the limit that we make this more and more accurate, we can make it as equivalent as we need to. And so that, we can then construct what we call a controlled knot gate. We take this sequence. So here's the target here's the control qubit and the target qubit. Remember, if this pair is in the state 0, it does nothing. But if it's in the state 1, then it sort of has this magic effect that's equivalent to just braiding the two target quasi particles. And so that effective braiding is all within an oval. So that rule I told you earlier about no leakage when you braid within an oval applies. And so again, in the limit that we make, if we make this more and more accurate, there's no leakage. In this case, there will be some leakage error, or rather the unitary transformation we produce will induce some transitions to the state from 1 to 0. But that's, again, on one part in 1,000 or so. And by systematically improving it with Soloveitch-Kateyev, we can make it better and better. Chetan's gone. Yeah. That's a bad sign. I'm almost done. Right. Lock the doors. Yeah. Okay. Let me just give you one more construction, which is a generalization of the what I showed you earlier. Another trick, or another sort of useful quantum macro or something for one of these topological quantum computers, is this funny weaving pattern where, again, you can think of this as the control pair in the state with Q-spin 1, weaving it through the target in such a way that the operation it produces is the identity. So it does nothing. But what that really means is it does nothing to the Hilbert space. It does permute the particle. So it takes the blue particle. You know, you can see we restrict our brute force search to ones where it comes in on top and comes out on the bottom. And so we call this an injection weave because we can use it, as I've shown here. So here's that, again, that start. Here's the control qubit. The control pair is in the state 1, so it's a single, represented as a single particle. We can run this injection weave. And what it does is it basically injects the control pair into the target without changing any of the quantum numbers. This is approximately the identity. So whatever the state of the target qubit was here, the state of this injected target is the same, except we've replaced the green particle in the middle with the control pair. So once we've injected, we're inside this oval, then we can weave to our heart's content. So here's, again, that's just the injection. So here, if we zoom in on this injected target, now here's that weaving pattern I showed you earlier that approximated a knot gate to one part in 10 to the 3. So we can do a knot gate on the target, on the injected target. Then once we're done, we can run the inverse of the injection weave, or the ejection, I don't know, there's no good name for this. We extract the control pair and return it back to the control qubit. And if we put it all together, we get this gate here, where, again, here's the injection. And again, I'll remind you, if the pair's in the state 0, all of this stuff does nothing. That's automatically taken care of. So if the control qubit is in state 0, we do nothing. If the control qubit is in state 1, we inject the pair into the target, and then we can carry out a knot gate, and then we extract it. And so we do, this does a controlled knot gate. And we can improve this, again, with a Soloveitch-Kateyev algorithm. And if we do one round, I mean, basically, and the way we do it is we improve each segment separately. So this is a little worrisome, but this is actually, I didn't make this last night, So this is only 10 to the minus 4 I can make 10 to the minus 6. It just won't fit on one slide. In the second part of the talk, I was going to talk about slightly more efficient constructions, but I'll stop here, essentially. Just to summarize, this is sort of answered the question of at least one way to take these Fibonacci anions and actually encode a computation, because we can produce single qubit gates by braiding the three particles, by encoding qubits and braiding within a qubit, and we can also carry out controlled NOT gates. So this, you know, if you hand me a quantum circuit, we can turn it into a braid which approximates that quantum circuit to whatever accuracy is necessary, which is sort of was essentially a compiler for one of these topological quantum computers. As I say, maybe 100 years too early, but this is my, I guess this is my last slide, so I'll stop there. Thanks.
More questions?
What about preparation and readout?
Yeah, I didn't say anything about that. And there are different schemes. One way, sort of, that again, this is the scheme you can read about in papers by Michael and Kateyev and others, is you can initialize these things by, again, it's easy to say, pulling a quasi-particle quasi-hole pair out of the vacuum. That pair will have Q spin zero in this language, because the vacuum has Q spin zero. And so if I pull, you know, I can pull, you know, I pull, two of these particles out. This is a particle, antiparticle. It has total Q spin zero. And then I pull another one out. That has total Q spin zero. And in fact, I could use this as a qubit. I could use these four as a qubit. But to get the qubits I'm talking about, you can just take this guy and throw it away. Because then, remember that if this is Q spin zero and I add a single Fibonacci anion, this has Q spin one. Then, so you can make your qubits, and then you braid them. And actually, one of the nice properties of this particular construction is, at the end of the braid, you'll always have quasi-particles and quasi-holes sitting inside these ovals at the end also. So then the readout is you try and fuse them. You actually try and bring them together. If they can only annihilate if their Q-spin is zero. So if they annihilate, and you can somehow you measure the charge with a quantum point contact or single electron transistor or something, if they annihilate, they're in the state, it was in the state Q spin zero. If they don't annihilate, they're in the, they were in the state, if they have Q spin one, they can't annihilate, so there'll be some charge distribution left. So it's actually very much like the singlet, triplet, spin-based quantum computing. It's
like that?
Because the vacuum has Q spin zero.
So they cannot annihilate and...
Well, I mean...
For this case that
doesn't happen. Let's see.
You must get left with a different type of particle.
You get left with a different type of particle, which will have some
gap, and it's, you know, pinned there, it just sits there.
Right.
You have to somehow measure that it's there.
Right, but it's presumably, it's a matter, I mean, if
it has the same quantum numbers as the vacuum, presumably,
interesting,
isn't it?
Right.
It could be uncharged.
I mean, it's going to, I mean, this is
going to be hard to tell if it's there or not.
Well, I mean, I'm sorry, if it has Q spin 1, and I bring them together, I think the net charge will be zero, but there will presumably be some charge distribution in that uniform.
The net electric charge will be zero.
Different energy, though.
Well, that's another point, of course.
Energy. Maybe it's hard to measure.
It's also true, as you bring these together, even...
Yeah, you can measure capacitively.
As you bring these together, presumably the topological degeneracy is no longer exact also. And so the charge distribution, you can even see that in some of those preliminary numerics, Haldane and others. I mean, again, if you can, and the long list of impossible things you have to do, that's just one more item. You have to measure it becomes possible to locally distinguish between 0 and 1 when you bring them close enough together. So you don't even have to fuse them completely.
But does that not also play a role with these fluctuations you are so afraid of? I mean, if you have an anion and you have a pair, you create a pair out of one, and you go around it, so to destroy some kind of global property, but then they cannot annihilate anymore. So you have a problem also, which means that you go to another state, which is presumably again higher up.
No,
then it's not a virtual process anymore.
No, they can go. Go on with one anion, not annihilate, and then go and wind another anion, and then come back to the zero state and annihilate.
And that is.
But they mean they put some mark on the state of the anion.
Then you are certainly talking about extremely suppressed processes. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, are there more questions? If not, let's thank Nick.